Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM.
Music,
honey, I live music. Morning, noon, a whole night. Everything else is just icing on the cake, you dig?
I dig.
All right, you're probably wondering what I'm doing, but this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special, the night we get a guest in to pick the tunes. And tonight it's the Irish director in film and television, Dervla Walsh, and one of her many jobs was to work on EastEnders. No doubt that will come up at some point. Dervla, it's great to have you here.
That must be a first for you, playing the EastEnders theme tune.
It probably is, but you know, I think it won't be the last. I've become strangely attached to it.
It's funny the way you just can't get away sometimes from the things that you've done that are so popular. Directing EastEnders was like, you know, maybe if I'd read the news, the most popular thing to do on TV. And it turns up on every CV, every conversation ever since. So no matter what I do, it's so hard to escape categorisation.
I know. Well, I'm sorry to categorise you so early on, but it had to be done. In a sense, we've got it over with. We've got it out of the way. Let's start in Tubbercurry then.
Yeah.
County Sligo. It sounds, on the face of it, a long way away from a career in film and television. So what was it like in Tubbercurry?
Well, I grew up in a guest house called Crookhorn House. My mother turned our home into a business, and the selling point for staying in our house was that we were 20 miles from everywhere. From Knock, from the sea, from Sligo. Growing up in Tubbercurry, I have really fond memories of growing up in Tubbercurry. I suppose because it's home, it was small, it was all you knew. Kind of grew up in a very strong community. My parents were involved in lots and. Mostly in the local drama, the Western Drama Festival, which my mother was secretary of, and my father acted with the Charlestown Players. So I grew up in a house that was full of people. It was like a train station, people coming and going all of the time, and it was quite chaotic. And
brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I'm the eldest of four, and brother Alan, Creese, and Brian, and my mum was from Glenamaddy in Galway. My dad was from a small farm on the Sligo Mayo border. And I think she just, both of them obviously, but she particularly wanted us to have the things that they didn't have. So my passions growing up were, I really loved poetry, and she got us into elocution, and she started baking cakes and selling them down at the outside the church gate to make extra money to kind of get us the extra
thing. Did we say, I don't know if we did or not, what did your folks do for a living?
Dad initially worked in Tool and Gage, which was a local factory, and then he went on, he was an engineer in Abbott Laboratories in Sligo. Mm. He's retired now and at home. And my mum kind of did everything. I mean, she was a stay-at-home mother who was rarely at home. And as I said, ran a B&B, became director of tourism in the Northwest, would take on Kerry, Clare, all of the places that got busloads of tourists.
Sounds
and
like
managed to get them to Tubbercurry.
A mighty woman.
Yeah, she was a big influence, and very much kind of pushed us to get on and dream big. So I suppose Tubbercurry was a wonderful kind of small town to grow up in, but It was always about looking out and looking bigger and travelling.
Okay, your first musical choice then?
Well, my first musical choice is an odd choice because by our record player at home, there were very few records because I didn't really grow up in a house with a lot of albums. But there was one album that was stuck to the side of it with this woman's face and long black hair and signature glasses who just didn't make music look cool at all. And that was Nana Mouskouri. And I've picked her as the first. It was kind of going between this and Santa Lucia, which was my mother's party piece. And this maybe as an indication of just how I was a late developer in life. So I had no musical influences growing up. As I said, we were a kind of a people came and did party pieces. And This Amazing Grace was, while it's not my favourite rendition of Amazing Grace at all, but it was also, this is the song that our mother left Tubbercurry in the coffin going down the aisle out to Rue. And so the song is meaningful. And Nana, well, I asked my father recently why, like, because I thought, you know, we didn't have the Beatles or we didn't have, you know, where did Nana come from? He said, well, she was on the telly. My parents were people who really danced all the time, went to the show bands. My mother loved dancing. And, you know, they went to dinner dances. And I was always envious of the girls who had older brothers and sisters and had heard of Leonard Cohen and Van Morrison. And I really didn't hear of any of those until I was in college. So I was always a bit embarrassing, my musical taste.
Nothing to be embarrassed about. We'll talk about all that in a minute. So here's Nana. Dervla Walsh is with me in studio tonight picking all the tracks, and that's her first choice, Nana Mouskouri singing Amazing Grace, which has big sort of childhood memories for you. Of course, she was on television all the time, yeah. Nana Mouskouri. Oh, she was genuinely on a lot.
She was kind of the TV star of the time. I mean, she's seemingly 200 albums in 12 languages, and she had a show on, she must have been on RT because we grew up in one channel land.
But what about radio then? I mean, surely the radio was on all the time in the house.
Yeah, the huge radio was always on. I'm just back, I've been staying with my father for the last while down at home, and the radio was on nonstop, Radio 1. And often I'd remember kind of coming into the kitchen and maybe occasionally finding my mother in tears in the corner and her covering it up and wondering why. And now I know it was kind of the Gay Byrne hour, you know, and there's always those incredibly sad stories. What was it, Dear Frankie, with the Jacobs, brought to you by
kind of
Jacobs
a problem
biscuits.
Page kind of a thing.
Yeah, so I mean, I think radio was a lifeline for so many people, radio, because we didn't have a cinema. We didn't have, you know, Sligo was 20 miles away. There was no car. My father walked to work then. You know, my mother, through the baking, bought a car for £20, put four new wheels on it, and it was our four new tyres. It was called Betsy. And we often went in and out to Sligo, and that the wipers didn't work, and it was one of our jobs to hang out the window and, you know, wipe it clean. I mean, kind of crazy stories that...
All right, your next choice, Dervla, is what?
Well, actually, the next choice is Johnny Cash and A Boy Named Sue, because I spent a lot of my childhood in Glenamaddy, County Galway, where my mother was from. Her family ran a shop there and garage and the local petrol pumps. And I used to work in the shop and one uncle ran the shop, and then the other uncle drove trucks and drove cattle up and down to Dublin, to the abattoir. I was a vegetarian for years afterwards. But traveling with him in his truck, he listened to Johnny Cash all of the time. He just loved country music. And Glenamaddy famously was, we know the Four Country Roads, but also was the Joe Neal's dance hall there, where it was the last mineral serving dance hall. So it was all this dance hall culture. And when I'd sleep with my granny, you could hear the dance music coming out of Quinn's Corner Bar. So very much, again, that very Philomena Begley, the country music. It always felt like a place where time had forgotten. So obviously Johnny Cash, my Uncle James, obviously did have good taste in music, because it's hard to pick a bad Johnny Cash number. And I just love the humour in this piece.
Okay, Johnny Cash.
Well, my daddy left home when I was 3, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me. Just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. If I ever have a son, I think I'm gonna name him Bill or George, any damn thing but Sue. I still ain't that man. Yeah.
And that's Johnny Cash. And a boy named Sue, the choice of Dervla Walsh, the director who's with me tonight in studio. When you went to school, Dervla, what you've described so far is that there wasn't much music in the house that was specifically your own. A couple of albums, whatever was on the radio. But when you went to school and you fell in with other girls, and I presume it wasn't a mixed school, maybe primary school.
Yeah, it wasn't a mixed school, yeah.
Was it, yeah? And a secondary school as well?
Secondary school, oh, yeah. Right. Morris Convent. A few, only a handful of boys, but yeah, there were...
Like the little English fella.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because I just assumed, that you would not have been at a mixed school.
No, it was... there was a primary school, and boys and girls were divided at first class. So there was a boys' school and girls' school. But then the secondary was mixed. And, and there was the whole tradition of the discos. You know, there's the fast set, was Mike's Disco in Charlestown. And there was the fast set that everybody loved. And then the slow set hit. And then the girls all took to the loo. The guys all took to one side. And it literally was, the boys one side and the girls one side. And that awful walk that the guys had to do to walk across the floor and ask you to dance. I remember my mother saying, now it takes a lot for a boy to cross the dance floor, so make sure you say yes. So I always said yes, even when I didn't want to. And then there was the rules that, I don't know who made them up, but if you stayed for more than one dance, you were, and 3 was, you were definitely snogging at the back of the hall by the end of the the night. I'd say thanks for the dance very much. And
I thought the DJs in my day, they had a real sense of male psychology, because after the slow set, which was inevitably disastrous for all concerned, it was followed by a whole lot of AC/DC songs.
Oh, that's exactly.
And, Rainbow and Deep Purple and...
Oh my God!
Headbanging, really.
Isn't it funny? You think you're
all the boys back on the floor again. Yeah.
But that was exactly a whole lot of
Rosie was the song. Yeah, whole lot of Rosie. Yeah.
And then all the boys with the black sweaty t-shirts and the air guitars. Yeah. It was quite huge. And then we had Smash Hits, the magazine that came out, and you'd get the lyrics of the songs and everything from them. Oh my gosh. The song I used to
Haircut
absolutely
100.
Love
Haircut,
was Pat Benatar, Love is a Battlefield.
She wasn't wrong.
So let's we shimmied up and down the dance hall.
Your next choice is not, however, Pat Benatar. But it was one of my favourite TV shows from the time.
Yeah.
It really was. And probably still would be if it was still on. Are you ready for this one? It's funny, I remember every second of that.
Ah, the Muppet Show, 6:15 on a Sunday and all gathered round. It was just, it was such an event, because there was just the absurdest humour in it, with the Swedish Chef and Kermit the Straight Man, Miss Piggy. And then they had the cameos, the guests each week and just offered themselves up to the Muppets and always allowed the Muppets to be stars. A great one with Miss Piggy dancing with Rudolf Nureyev.
Yeah, and the most extraordinary guest.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I mean, one of the reasons, I mean, apart from that, this was an event every Sunday watching this and the comedy of it and the also, I think, just enjoying the theatre of it and kind of access to front of house and back of house, which is no accident with where I ended up. But there was, I used to think I could sing. Like growing up, I learned to play the guitar, I learned to play the piano. I did poetry, went to the local fashion and did...
recitations?
Yeah. I did my recitations because Sligo was famous, of course, for
I remember the freshening skill. There must have been maybe 500 girls in a row saying a poem about a rabbit. I can probably still remember it.
Well, my famous one is because I ended up in Scornan Oak and going all the way from Killoran's to Kilmacteague to Roscommon up to the National Stadium in Dublin with "My dark fathers lived the intolerable day, committed always to the night of wrong." Brendan Kennelly's
that
was my father's proudest achievement for me.
When and where did you start to get some inkling of what you might be doing? Was this at school or after you left school?
Oh, I think it was after I left. I think in school, there just kind of seemed to be the same five things to do, you know, as a girl, like nursing, the civil service, teaching. Mm. And I was interested in law because I love Petrocelli and I just love the theatre of law and I loved the idea of, but I really didn't know anything about it. And there was this new thing about startup called computers. So somebody said that would be good to get into. But so I ended up going through my CAO form and it was by a process of elimination coming to communication studies because it sounded interesting. Like I was always interested in theatre, in acting, in reading, and I was always interested in photography. I took lots and lots of photos as a kid. So, but I really didn't know what it was, and also my mum was married at 25, as most of the mothers and were all, you know, that was kind of the average. So I thought, oh my God, at 25, I have to go get my education, do whatever I want to do and be ready to have it all done by 25 because then, you know, I'll be married and at home at 25. I mean, it was such a kind of a narrow view or I didn't realise.
This is not long ago.
This is not a huge amount of time ago.
But those things that you mentioned photography, acting and so on. To what level had you taken those things or were you just literally doing it on your own?
I was doing them on my own. Yeah. Like we didn't have that. It was a small school, kind of 120 students in the school. Yeah, so I went to communications. I arrived up to DCU or NIHE as it was known then. And I mean, I was interested because it offered learning in film, TV, radio and PR. And it was kind of quite a general course, but I absolutely loved college, made great friends and got really involved in student life and kind of, you know, joined the Film Society. I was kind of chairman of the Film Society, the Drama Society, Debating Society. I mean, I just had such an appetite.
And were your mother.
Fed. Basically, it was. Maybe that was it. I was my mother. And then in second year, our school placement, our college placement was, I was one of two people who did my placement here in RTE and it was for 3 weeks. And I came and there was nobody here. Everybody was on holidays and my job was, you know, was licking stamps and envelopes for the talent show of the day, screen test.
And it was then, busy in those days.
Yeah. And then I was, that was due to be over. And then the producers all came back from holidays and nobody knew how to access the information and that, you know, I had helped the secretary and put it into the computer. And so I got held on and that was the start of a beautiful relationship because the show... screen test, Anish Notaro, who went on to, we became great friends. It was the first music show that she directed and she really took me under her wing and asked me to I kind of almost became like her assistant, and it was amazing to watch her at work. She would work with singers and musicians, ask me to record them, and then I'd get all kind of playful and arty-farty with the camera. She gave me video cameras so that then she could go home and camera script, because obviously for all those shows you had to...
It escalated very fast then, didn't it?
Pardon?
It escalated very quickly.
Yeah, it was. And also I didn't realise... I didn't really know what a director did before college. Like, we didn't have access, as I say,
But I'd say when you started that course, you probably didn't have much of a notion of what television was, what radio was, what communications, that was what it was called, even what that was, really.
Well, the course was regarded as the joke course. That did anybody know? But it's only become fashionable kind of since the late 80s. But college was a real... it really kind of expanded my horizons in all the best possible ways.
Music?
Oh, yeah. There was somebody nobody'd heard of before, brought out this amazing album, and with a voice. Like, I just felt like I discovered her, and of course the world discovered her, and she keeps discovering herself since, and us along with her, Sinéad O'Connor.
Dublin in a rainstorm, sitting in the long grass in summer, keeping warm.
Sinéad O'Connor there, and Troy, the choice of Dervla Walsh, who's with me in studio. I remember Sinéad at that time when she first appeared, Dervla, and as Sinéad O'Connor, that is, and kind of, she just threw me completely. I hadn't seen anything like her before.
Yeah,
that sort of power and presence. And the look of her and everything, yeah. She was kind of extraordinary.
She was so other, wasn't she? And she just seemed like, I think maybe because, she was our age, and to see, somebody, we all think we have, or we come maybe to college with the naivety of that we've all had the same experience growing up. And then you meet this... Well, I didn't meet her, but I listened to this woman. It had such power in her voice, sung with such passion. And then, all her own kind of heartache and head wreck that came out after that. But she just seemed like somebody who just gave everything, heart and soul. She gave it everything.
You said an interesting thing there about, you go up to college in some, wherever it is, from wherever you come from. And you kind of naively do think that you have lived the only kind of life that there sort of is. You think everybody's going to be like you. It's not in an arrogant way, but you don't know anything else. And you just assume everybody kind of thinks the same and feels the same. And the great thing is suddenly you're introduced to other ways of thinking.
Yeah. I mean, we laugh about this now. And the friend who it is... laughed about it with me, but I remember there were five of us who became friends very, very quickly, and we were all from rural parts of Ireland. It was kind of Lanesborough, Ballylongford, Rockcurry, Athlone, Tubbercurry, so all very rural Ireland. And I can remember sitting around the table at the canteen one lunchtime, and one of the girls saying that her parents were separated. And I just remember being shocked, A, that her parents were separated, and B, that she said they were.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real indication of course those things were going on at home in Tubbercurry, but people didn't talk about it, and what people presented to the world. And, my own, naivety. I mean, now when I think, like, if I was bringing up my own kids, I would just so force them to have as much experience as possible.
It seems that you really threw yourself into university life, which is good advice for anybody listening. If you join everything, get involved in everything.
Yeah.
Don't stay in bed.
Oh, yeah. God, I loved college. It was like when I started work, I loved working. I just absolutely loved the diversity, loved how much was available to you, and loved I don't know, just the energy of it. And communications was, you know, we had lots of free time. And also, I think he came from the, you know, hothouse of where, you know, you studied hard for your Leaving Cert and coming to college. It was, you know, suddenly, you know, nobody was making you do anything. So certainly, you know, all those energies were going into clubs and societies. But I also think a part of that was also moving away from home,
yeah.
You know, and being in digs for the first year and then being allowed to move in with a girl from home for the second year. And then the third year I was finally allowed to move in with my friends. I mean, I think being the eldest, you know, my parents were strict and, you know, it was he'd kind of be coming home every other weekend. And our grandfather lived with us at home and he'd kind of slip you a tenner on the way back. And you go down and say, I'm taking the bus back to Dublin. But you'd start thumbing back. So you had that other extra tenner that should make you last. You know, just I mean, those two £10 extra £10 were just like would give you so much more during the week. So I think the experience I always feel for it. I know now kids have to go to college where they live or are living at home for longer. And, you know, a lot of my friends and their kids are still at home and many of them like it. But God, I just can't imagine the college experience being a student living at home, because part of it was about being away and working things out and surviving and your parents not knowing things and you having this covert life, you know, the version you presented at home, which was, you know, if you came home with the grades and not pregnant and just the, I also think the friendships I made there were huge.
Yeah.
Really.
Your next choice, you know, certainly suggests good nights out, parties, fun.
Yeah.
And the social side of college is just as important as the rest of it, really, isn't it? I mean, you've got to enjoy yourself when you're there too.
Absolutely. But straight after college, I signed up like everybody else for a FOSS course, to do a film course. And, you know, we were going to be, you know, graduated with no work. It was 1988 and there was little or nothing happening. And I got a call from Granada TV. I'd been one of two people recommended for an interview and I ended up going to Granada TV the day after my grandfather's funeral and going up to Dublin the night before, sleeping on the floor of somebody's flat and then, you know, going over to Manchester the next day. And anyhow, ended up working with Granada TV. And so James is from both my time in Granada and just the next door opening into working life and being able to afford things. And this song captures such a fun time.
On from James, Dervla Walsh is with me in studio tonight. Dervla, film director and television director, who's picking all the tunes tonight. And just, you know, we've moved through this quite quickly, Dervla, because actually it seems to have moved quite quickly for you in terms of career. Mm. You kind of went from college into RTE to sort of help them to do something. Then you were asked to stay to help them do something that nobody in the building was able to do. Mm. And you hung around. It all moved very fast. So before long, you're in Manchester, you're working with Granada, a TV company with a good rep, Coronation Street, yeah?
Yeah, that's what paid the bills, yeah.
And those sort of Tony Wilson programmes, those Manchester
Yeah, I worked with Tony
scenes.
Wilson and he did, there was an arts show, The Other Side of Midnight, and another arts documentary show called Celebration, which I started life in the promos department editing trailers for films and TV programmes. So my job was to make a programme look interesting and exciting in 30 seconds.
Were you learning on the hoof or were you fit to go when you got to Granada?
I was very much learning on the hoof because the first time I directed was after a year had moved onto a show called The New, which was an arts show, which your job was to promote what was coming on, but come up with ideas to promote them. And there was an 80-piece percussion orchestra that we had an hour and a half with. They could only give us that amount of time in the morning. And I was the researcher, and I had set everything up for the director, and the music was on the theme of, I think, the steam age. And I had got beautiful archive film from the Granada Library, and I'd worked out a way that the director could shoot with two cameras, the main camera, and strap a second camera to the side. But we didn't have time for tracks, put him in a wheelchair, wheel him up and down, and anyhow, it all set up and ready to go, and there was no sign of the director. And Julian Farina, who now is a kind of director in Hollywood, but I said, Julian, you know, we only have an hour and a half with these. And he said, Dervla, you do it. And I said, but I've never directed before. And he said, Dervla, you know more about this than I do. You can direct it. Go ahead and direct. And that was the first piece, and it was like a music piece, a 3-minute music piece. And then I had a year of working on that show, just constantly writing up ideas and being inventive about how to promote various arts events.
Sounds like you had a lot of freedom.
Yeah, huge freedom. I mean, I remember doing the interview for Granada, and they said to me, where do you see yourself? And I said, well, I see myself, I'd like to be a director, because I definitely knew that's what I wanted to do after working in RTE with Anita. And they said, and when do you see that? And I thought, oh, I better not come across as too cocky and coming from Ireland. And said, well, in 10 years. They said, in 10 years? You need to cut that in half. In 5 years, if you're not a director, actually, if you're still in our department in 2 years, we will consider that we've made a wrong choice. And I was blown away at that attitude of freedom to move up through, because that was not the Ireland that I left, where you...
Yeah. That's,
you know your place, and don't get above it, and put in your time, put in your apprenticeship, and very strong unions, and you know, not that I'm anti-union at all, but just things that kept you in place rather than allowed you to bloom, and Granada very much, and I was at Granada at the time when the unions were just being broken, so I kind of ended up directing really very quickly. And so when I came back to do a producer director course in RTE, 2.5 years earlier, they didn't have anything for me. And then, when I did come back, I just had, you know, all this experience. And I think also there was that attitude of, you know, if you've made it over there, you must be okay.
But that was a good experience you had in Manchester then.
Yeah, it was really a wonderful
experience.
You were
lucky, actually.
It was all about experiencing new experiences and seeing live music, art exhibitions, going to the cinema. The Corner House was the art house cinema. I mean, it was just exposed to a whole level. The Tate just opened in Liverpool. Manchester had such a vibrant
art scene. Did you do what you'd been encouraged to do and move through the place within 2 years?
Yeah. You know, at speed. I was in the promos department for a year, and then I moved in. I became a researcher and worked in a regional arts show, and then I wanted to learn about film, and so I became a film documentary researcher, and I had just kind of done two documentaries as a pure researcher, which was also a really interesting experience going out. One of the documentaries I did was with a director who went on to become a drama director by finding the next L.S. Lowry's in the Northwest. And my job was, like, Granada gave me a car to, like, I spent a month driving out throughout the Northwest, just into small towns, trying to find unheard of artists. And it's incredible. It was a really incredible experience.
And did you, given the freedom you had and the trust that had been placed in you and how quickly you were clearly learning how to do things, did you at that point have a notion where you wanted this to end up? I mean, did you think, I want to be doing this or that? I want to be a director of this kind of program or this kind of film?
What was evolving definitely was an interest in drama, in getting involved in working with writers. And because I had always lots of great ideas with the camera and, you know, lighting and do be funky, do this, do that and the other. But, you know, that kind of, that was almost like making music videos. And I suppose I was looking for something with more substance in, than that, and to kind of move into the sphere of storytelling. And and really one of the big things that I, you know, that I was really interested in and still am, and what I love about it is the idea of collaboration. So of me having an idea, but I don't have all the tools. I'm not a writer. I mean, I told you earlier on that I learned rather late that I couldn't sing, and the importance of learning your weaknesses as well as your strengths, because I did force an awful lot of people to listen to some bad singing for a long time, not realizing how bad I was. So I kind of learned, I wrote lots of bad poetry. And and thought I wanted to write drama as well as direct it. I remember friends saying, you know, there's very few people who can do both, you know. And so my interest was in collaboration and working with writers. And
well, in the next part of the program, we're going to talk about some of the things that you have worked on. Not least recently, it's a nice thing to have at the top of your CV at the minute, Handmaid's Tale. Mm. So we'll discuss some of these things after the break. But we'll be leading up to the break, let's have another piece of music from you. Penguin Cafe Orchestra, I bet you use this in an arts programme.
That is exactly. How predictable did. Am I? No, when I heard this, I thought it was.
I bet you did. Would you use a lot of Eric Satie as well?
Oh, gosh. I loved the sound of the harmonium and the...
Okay, here it comes. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. My guest tonight is Dervla Walsh, film and television director, and she's picking all the tunes tonight. We're having a fine time playing some fine music. Before the break, Penguin Cafe Orchestra, music for a found harmonium, which you used back in the day in Granada. But you were learning, I guess, doing that, the power that music can have on a film. And we were just talking during the break there how it can actually... You might have a problem with telling the story or a problem with the visuals, and it's the music that makes it work.
I'm always amazed. I mean, the editing process of directing is always kind of reveals such new things to you. But I mean, I've just you mentioned Handmaid's Tale earlier. Just done an episode of Handmaid's Tale, and there's a point in the story when June she's had this interview with the Swiss, and it's been quite a wordy 4 or 5 minute piece. And at the end on the script, I mean, the writer had quite complex stage directions for the actress about what she was supposed to play, like kind of impossible to play.
And she can do it though.
Yeah, and what she can do. But what we did was we just extended the sequence to getting her up out of the chair, taking, you know, it'd been a very static scene, using the camera to walk her out, stay on her face, do it all as a continuous shot. So you see her public face to the Swiss, come through the doors, walk down a long corridor, all in Steadicam. And as she walks, she gets more swagger, and then she puts on her hood like she's putting on, you know, putting up the collar of her coat. And in the edit, we put the Buddy Holly piece, "Every Day Seems a Little..." And it just was powerful at the point, and it was at the end of Act Two, of just showing, oh my gosh, there's hope. She's on. Of course, it's all going to fall apart by the end of the next act. But just how music can lift and also kind of give movement to something. That's what I loved about that track there. How in music, the sense of movement and energy in a piece, and when you put that over pictures, what it does.
And you have to be really smart about music, don't you? Because we've all seen movies where the music tells you exactly how you're supposed to feel, because the orchestra starts to swell, and you go, "Oh, right, I'm supposed to feel upset now." Whereas something like Handmaid's Tale, Peaky Blinders does it as well. Mm. Lots of movies have now cottoned on to doing it. They play something which on the face of it is completely wrong. Mm. It's the wrong tempo even. And yet it's perfect, you know?
Yeah, it's so interesting that, isn't it? Just when you juxtaposition.
And would that be your call in a situation like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's lots of different ways of working with the composer, and sometimes you bring the composer in early and sometimes they don't come in till the end. But for example, like when you have the good luck of working with the composer early, like I would get them to read the script and come back to me with their interpretation of the story, because what you're doing all the time as a director is pulling people together, who, you know, making sure you're all telling the same story, but just that the, you know, whatever your take on the story is, it chimes with them. So a musician, a composer, obviously reacts and expresses completely differently and beautifully to a piece. And
but I think it's interesting the way people use found music, I guess, or records that already exist.
Yeah. Editors are amazing, and what they're editors by their nature are kind of quiet people who sit in a dark room with no windows all day, and you know, work away at the pictures, and aren't particularly. Not apparently sociable, and they have huge music collections. They're so you come in with your music thoughts, and then they I always say to an editor, don't tell me what you're doing, just surprise me. I know what I want, but and then, you know, we've got a conversation, and then they'll put a piece of music, and often things like that in the edit can come from the editor who's sitting there all day, who just draws on their record collection.
See, one of the things you said before the break was that one of the reasons you're interested in working in drama was collaboration, was working with other people. Mm. And I mean, it's obvious you're going to work with a writer, you're going to work with actors, but it's people like the editors, if they're good ones, that can make or break something just by removing a second or two from it, you know.
There are so many different ways to edit a scene, and also how you get on with your editor, because you're sitting, the editor meets you at a point in the process where you've been on set probably, you know, directing anything from 80 to 150 people, and nothing happens until you say go. So, and you know, you're at a crazy schedule of 5 plus 8 every morning, you're behind already, and so it's the filming part is incredibly intense. And then when you move into the edit suite, it's this, you know, quiet. It's like being here, John. Just all very silent. There's
we
coffee
just
and
make it look easy.
Yeah, and the editor, you know, gets this crazy person into the room who spends all the time going, "Oh my God, we plan to do this. Oh, you should have seen it." Yeah. And then the editor goes, "Would you like to go out and just, you know, you get the coffees and come back?" They're like a therapist listening to you unwind. Yeah. And you know, a good editor will say, "Nobody knows what's outside the frame. They only know what's inside
good
the frame."
Good point, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're thinking of everything that's not. Yeah.
And just, you know, whether an editor sits on one shot or cut something quite quickly, or also that, you know, they say the story is written 3 times at the script stage, on the set with the actors, and then in the edit, and always being open to that.
Music choice.
Well, actually, on that, I wonder about Preisner's Requiem for my friend, because he did all the music for Kieslowski's films, 3 colours, red, blue, white, the Decalogues, and I think made incredible work.
From Preisner, Requiem for My Friend, the choice of Dervla Walsh is with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. We're just talking there, Dervla, about the collaborative side of working as a director, and working with editors, working with composers. And I'd be curious to two other parts to that equation. I'd be interested to know how you deal with people. You said earlier that you weren't a writer. So how do you deal with writers? Composers have to be generous in terms of they have to serve the pictures. But I have this impression maybe the writers think they've handed you something perfect and it's your job to make it happen. But then you've got, you know, you look at it and go, well, that actually won't work, you know. That can be tricky, I'd imagine.
I think of all the stages in production, it is the trickiest. And it's the trickiest, I think, because everything has to be in the script. It has to be. I worked with somebody who once said you can't grade emotion. If it's not there in the script, or if there's a problem you don't solve, like you just it never goes away. So I've huge respect for writers because I think it, you know, takes obviously so much, and they're coming up with the original ideas and they sit by themselves at the blank page, and God help them, and in, you know, they have to do so many rewrites and so much is expected to be done for nothing. So when I come on board to work with, and fortunately I had a very good first experience with a writer when I worked here in RTÉ. I did a series called Eku Eku and worked with a young writer, and we had a really great creative relationship for a while, Marina Nicovon. And so I kind of learned a lot about, you know, being in the writer's head. So now when I, you know, obviously every drama I would start to work with a writer, it's really about, I've been sensitive with the relationship, but I never take on something that I don't have a reaction to the script, that there isn't something about the script that I love. So and what I want to do is serve the writing, and the writing's job is to be provocative and to amuse the director. And I worked with one writer who the first script was brilliant and the second script had problems. And we went, I was absolutely dreading this day, the page turn, sitting down with we'd had a good first day. And then the second day I was going, oh my gosh, because it really needed a lot of work. And I was going, how do you, you know, because there's also script editors and producers sitting around, so they're exposed, and it's very, very difficult. So I just remember starting the day by saying, just remember, I'm your best friend in this room, because I've got to get it. And
when you're working though on, and I'm just picking things at random that you've worked on, The Handmaid's Tale, Fargo, Penny Dreadful, you know, The Tudors, Little Dorrit, these sorts of things. Presumably these are all writers who really know what they're at, and these problems don't arise quite so much, I would guess.
Yes and no.
Yeah, okay. Right. But you know, the next episode of The Handmaid's Tale has to be made quickly, you know. I'm sure there's great pressure to get the thing done, and I would have thought maybe you're working with the best people you could possibly find. You know?
Yeah, but there are, in something like that, there are also writers' rooms, and you've got a showrunner who really has created the voice and the tone of the show, which, for example, The Handmaid's Tale, Bruce Miller did in the first series. And then in the American system, there's a writer's room, and there are a lot of writers from theatre, and the writing can all be, they all, you know, the showrunner, you know, breaks down the story, and sometimes he'll hand an episode out to a writer, or will maybe hand a character out to a writer. So it's not always the script you get as organic as it should be. So
just tell me again exactly what the showrunner's job is, because that's kind of an American thing, is it, as opposed to anything. It doesn't happen here, does it? Maybe there's a different name for it, I don't know.
No, it's really, because really the writer is king in America. The writer is creative king, where really in the British system, the producer has been king. In the European system, kind of in the film, the director. And I suppose in Ireland, we fall between a few stools. And
So
the showrunner is the person who basically is responsible, creatively responsible for presenting and for executing the idea. And really, it's like their baby. So Vince Gilligan and Breaking Bad on Fargo, and they create the characters, they pitch the series, they run the writer's room, and often or sometimes they pilot, they shoot the first
episodes. So then what was your experience with Fargo then, where did you have more freedom to veer off in different directions?
Absolutely, because I mean, the first thing that was said when I arrived at Fargo was, you know, you're expected to, now there's some really wonderfully creative things in the script, but also to, you know, bring your own imagination to bear and to do your own thing. And, you know, they would say to you, you know, we've employed you because we love what you do, and, you know, come and do your thing. So it's not, so while there's a certain tone, you know, there's in Fargo, there's a maybe a particular tone in terms of maybe the type of lenses that are used or the wide shots, or maybe, you know, it's not covered to death. There still is room to flex your muscles. I mean, it's a debate in the American drama. The dramas are shot in kind of 8 to 10 days. It's incredibly fast. Yeah. I mean, I've just worked on a show called Tales from the Loop with Nathaniel Halpern, who worked on Legacy, and there's 10 beautiful films. Really, they're all separate films, and he got a different director to work on. Jodie Foster did one, the Pixar director did another. He picked directors from very different backgrounds and to do each episode, so that each episode, while Nathaniel has written them all, so there's, you know, the his kind of strong presence of the writing, each episode has a very very different feel and atmosphere and tone to it.
Are you easy and comfortable in that scenario? It seems to me like serious pressure, you know, having to show up to different people all the time and sort of prove what you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think you would think at this stage I'd you know, take it in my stride, but actually maybe this is a flaw of mine, but every time it's like starting for the first time.
I'd imagine it would be.
Yeah, because it is, because you're forming new relationships every, and also I choose to work on work that challenges me in some way that I haven't done before. Often, you know, it's like when I did Shameless, all you get offered are Northern comedies. When I did a children's drama, all you get offered is just like I said there at the beginning, people are desperate to keep you in a box. And so I'm constantly trying to break out of that box. So I mean, I did a Marvel one, a Punisher, a couple of years ago, just so, you know, I could do some action sequences and prove, you know, I'm not a girly director, but also, so I choose stories that I can kind of connect with and that are challenging in some ways. So
music,
Thomas Newman's 6 Feet Under, because
there's no, you don't have to, yeah, you don't need to, yeah, give a reason for this, do you really? Feet Under, music from Thomas Newman. Dervla Walsh with me in studio tonight, picking the music. Dervla, we're just talking there about what it's like to work on these big TV series, which are more important than movies now at the moment, I kind of feel, you know. That's where all the best stuff is being made. Are you now completely devoted to television? I mean, for instance, if you were offered a big blockbuster movie, would you go for it, or would you think, no, I'm busy enough doing what I'm doing?
Yeah, no, I mean, I wouldn't go for the big blockbuster just because it's a big blockbuster, and I've read plenty of those scripts. But I mean, I do want to make my own film, and I've been close a few times. I worked with Emma Donoghue on her first book, Stir Fry, and had another film script, Napoleon and Betsy, that we had Elle Fanning and Viggo Mortensen attached to. In the film world, it's such a slow process. And it's just been so close so often. And I have another script at the moment, The Housekeeper, which is the origin story of Rebecca, which would be I'm working on. But I guess I can't afford to sit around and wait for those to happen, but plugging away. And the thing is, I'm just getting to work, and there's so much great TV drama at the moment, and great stories. The canvas is much longer and larger. You can really get into.
I know they're two different things, but it's very hard to get as much satisfaction from a movie anymore when you know what you can get from watching a full box of Sopranos or Breaking Bad or whatever it is.
And this is where the industry is really suffering because, you know, people aren't going out to the cinema. So hence the huge Marvel films, and it's all about effects and and very hard to get, you know, the smaller films made. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I stayed up way too late last night watching Unbelievable, which is... it's so addictive box sets. I heard Helen Mirren say the other day, she's in Catherine the Great at the moment, that all this time, that you know, that she watches so much on Netflix as well. And she said all this time that's spent by so many people in creating, you know, 4, 6, 8, 10 hours of drama, and then it's gobbled up in a couple of sittings on Netflix, and they go next. So, you know, there's but the standards, I think, are just getting... just higher and higher. I mean, so much of the work I'm doing at the moment, they're each like individual films. Like, as I said, Tales of the Loop. They're you are going out doing Handmaid's Tale. I'm about to work on the new series of Fargo, and they're almost like self-contained features.
What was it along the way that got you from, say, doing Ross Naroon, nothing wrong with that either, but got you from there to where you are now? Was it winning an Emmy? Is that the thing that turns it?
No, I would say way before the Emmy, there was a period of just, like, I was always clear and knew that I wanted to get into drama. And when I was here in RTÉ, I did all that could be done, a kind of a drama documentary and Anne Enright's first film. And then, you know, the arrogance of youth, I set up a company with this other writer, and we were going to change the world. And we did a couple of pilots. I'm quoted in the Sligo Champion somewhere that I wanted to be Ireland's Jane Campion and direct the first feature film, Mosquelga. I mean, how embarrassing when that's represented. And then just there was a long period, and I think by the, you know, where there was no drama being made here in Ireland, and all the work that was coming in, they were bringing their key creatives in, you know, the writers, the directors, and I did a lot of music shows, and I learned how to read scores of music. I directed the AXA piano competition. I did the opening of T.G. Cahir. I did a lot of bigger music things. And documentaries, but I just I just could not get into drama. I just could not make that break. All my work and my showreel was Oscuelga, and I think if it had been French, you know, American or British producer would have thought it was interesting, but I think they thought differently. And it was very visual work because I specifically also did Irish language drama that I wanted people who didn't understand the language to watch and understand. So I kind of hit a wall at the Millennium, and I kind of gave up. And a friend invited me to a wedding to Sydney. And I just couldn't. And I thought I think I was about 31, 32. I just said, I'm not going to make it. I'm going to be stuck doing, you know, what I can do quite easily. And kind of very disappointedly and kind of really giving up, I went to Sydney to a friend's wedding and went for a month. And I ended up staying 7 months. And I think it was what I call my gap year. And it was the first time I'd taken time out. And most people will go and as they should, go and travel and do the Australian thing or the Canadian thing before or after college. So it was the first time I stopped. And it was amazing to stop. And at that then I wanted to do anything but direct. I was interested in counting penguins and learning how to make becoming a barista. And I travelled and just also, you know, had my eyes opened in another way in kind of in life and love and travels. And then just in that way that sometimes when you're banging on the door and nobody answers and then you stop banging, somebody called. And I ended up coming back and working on a kids comedy drama that was Custer's Last Stand-Up. And I came in on the second block. And really, that was kind of the start because I worked with a fabulous Northern Irish BBC producer and who just kind of minded me, and that went on to win a BAFTA. And then I came and led it the following year. And the fun, work makes work, success makes success.
I mean, on your that business, winning awards works, doesn't it?
Yeah. So
it seems
so,
to.
Yeah.
It seems
so
to help.
I won a BAFTA, or I didn't win. The show won a BAFTA, and then somebody on that knew the new, you know, the new series producer in EastEnders, and he went on to become head of Channel 4, recommended me for a series called Shameless, and
which
it's
was
a series
massive.
Of accidents.
Shameless was a huge success, wasn't it? I mean, it was a massive,
it was,
big thing to be involved in.
I mean,
it changed television, didn't
I remember it? Getting the script of, reading the script of Shameless for the first time, saying, I've never read anything like this. Mm. It was absolutely, it was incredible. The, just characters that jumped off the page. It was outrageous. It was wild. It was anarchic. And Paul Abbott, you know, who I would say is kind of was Britain's first showrunner, he just had such a clear story of what he, vision of what he wanted to tell. And it was amazing working with him. And he created Frank Galler. And like they were all based on his relatives, his Irish past. And I really connected with it because it was just like a deeply, darkly dysfunctional family, which very much attracts me, the theme of those themes.
Even so, more dysfunctional than the families in EastEnders.
Yes. Well, in EastEnders, I learned, I remember producing EastEnders saying to me, if you can direct EastEnders, you can direct anything. And that's true because it was the toughest schedule I have ever worked
really,
on. I remember first AD saying to me, Dervla, for every minute you speak to the actors over the course of the day, that's 15 minutes, that's a scene we've dropped. Stop speaking to the actors. And I was going, now I know. This is not the show for me. So to
stop speaking to the actors.
Stop speaking to the actors. But I'm a director. That's my job.
And
to
they're
talk
actors.
To the actors. Yeah.
In fairness.
So, and the other thing I learned in EastEnders is when actors don't know what they're doing, they speak very loudly, very quickly. So that's always so it's
always
like
shouting at each other.
Yeah, always shouting at each other and speaking really fast. So, you know, one of the great things about drama is also the power of silence and quiet. And, you know, it's all about the subtext. So
next choice, Dervla?
Well, just because how lucky I was to get to work with Dustin Hoffman and Judi Dench. And it was a kind of a long story, but it happened in the end. And it was on a Richard Curtis adaptation of Roald Dahl's Ezio Trot. And Richard had written, adapted the story. He used to read it to his kids, but he had Mr. Hoppy, had a music collection of Louis Armstrong music collection, because he remembered his dad was a Louis Armstrong enthusiast. So this was A Kiss to Build a Dream On was a dance sequence that I got to work with Dustin and Judy on, and it was supposed to be a big huge dancing number, a huge big extravaganza that Richard had written, and in the end we did it incredibly simply and intimately between Judy, who had two new knees, and Dustin.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on.
A Kiss to Build a Dream On there. Louis Armstrong, the choice of Dervla Walsh, is with me in studio. Now, you casually, in the introduction to that, mentioned Dustin and Judy. Mr. Hoffman and Miss Dench. How are you with actors normally? And then how are you with actors where you'd be entitled probably to think, I've no business telling these people what to do at all. So and if you're with regular actors, how do you normally work? Now, I know you'd said in EastEnders you weren't supposed even to talk to them because it was taking up too much time. But in an ideal scenario?
Well, the first thing... I do sit down and talk with them about the story, about the scene, just show them that I, you know, understand the story or share my take on the story and gain their trust. And I think the most important thing is never to lie, never to bullshit an actor. And often, you know, the situation may arise that you have to because of a location or a schedule, but I just, but all there's so much work to be done before you go on set. Ideally, you want to go on set and everybody knows what they're doing. So what you're doing then is calibrating and giving notes. But ideally, the actor knows exactly what you've, I mean, I do what's called a page turn. I go through every scene, every word, every, you know, that we both understand what their ideas were. Because an actor will know their character and only their character, not so much the others, better than.
Well, you said, you know, you don't get to do that on EastEnders. But if you're working on, I mean, Handmaid's Tale or Fargo, yeah, or any of these, they're under massive pressure too. Do you get the time to spend
there? I make time. They don't get the time, but I make the time. So with Ewan McGregor on Fargo, on his day off, we sit down and we go through everything. And Ewan just wanted me to go so far. And a lot of it is they're nervous. They're really nervous. They're all film actors. They're nervous of often in TV that a different director is coming in and, you know, will they break it? Will they ruin it? And it's so intense on set about, you know, how, you know, will they try and make you do something different with the character that they don't want to do. So that's, it's like befriending them. So with Ewan, we would go so far and he'd say, that's all I need to know. The rest you can tell me on set. So just that he had a sense. And with Elizabeth on Handmaid's Tale, again, we would she works. She's in every scene and every day. But I mean, I think the reason why these people are so successful is they put the work in, and they're working on your day off or on the nights off. With Dustin, I mean, people used to say, "My God, are you nervous, intimidated by working with Dustin?" And I would really try not to think about that, but say he has a career of 50 years. He doesn't know me from Adam. He must be more nervous than me that I'm going to mess up his career. So, and with Dustin, I went over to LA for rehearsal period and sat with him for a week, and we sat down and we started to read the script. And after I was sitting here, he was sitting at right angles to me and he was reading. And of course, you know, there was nervousness and excitement and fear. And, you know, after a couple of scenes, he turned around to me and he said, "So, hey, how am I doing?" And, you know, I was just so aware in that moment, whatever came out of my mouth was going to be the most important thing, you know, because sometimes the trick is to say less. I remember Lenny Abramson saying, students are always asking me, how do you speak to actors? And I say to say as little as possible to them. Being Irish, that tends not to work for me when I'm abroad. But
it could be a trick. You know, he doesn't probably may not want you to say you're brilliant, Dustin.
Yeah. Dustin, and he quoted back to me at the end of the week because I said, the character, no, we're good, but the character isn't depressed. And he went, "It's not depressed. It's not depressed.
So he was paying attention.
And so by the end of the week, he took out another tape and showed me something and he said, "That's Mr. Hoppy." He was trying to find Mr. Hoppy.
See, I'd be more worried about Judi Dench because she seems just absolutely be in total command of any role she plays, anything.
Judi Dench is flawless. She's extraordinary. I mean, I had to invent a note just so that we'd get a second chance. We do a take and I got she was perfect. There was just absolutely nothing. And I'm going, I know we need another one for focus. I know we need, you know, the lighting wasn't quite there. So I'm on my way across and I'm trying to invent a note. And I can, Judy, you know, when you did this there, I mean, if you do next time, and you'd never normally, you know, direct an action, it's more, you know, the inner world. And she said, "Oh, Tarfala, I haven't a clue what I did. Let me just do something different."
Yeah, and I thought you might think, come on now. She probably knew exactly what was going on.
Oh, does she, you know.
Next choice, music.
Oh, another wonderful actress that I had the opportunity to work with when I was Saoirse Ronan, and it was doing a video with Hozier of Cherry Wine, which, it was my first time to do a music video, and brilliant to work with Saoirse and Mo Dunford. So, Cherry Wine.
Did you do this for the crack, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, they asked me. And also it was for a charity, domestic abuse. So, yeah, I did it for, you know, charity and for fun.
Thank you. That's Hosier there, and the video for that, Cherry Wine, was directed by my guest tonight, Dervla Walsh, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the tunes. It's fascinating hear you talking about working on those big series, but I've just forgotten to mention the fact that you've actually got an Emmy for one of them, Little Dorrit, back in the day.
Back in the day.
And when you do something like Little Dorrit, where the tone is obviously very different to The Handmaid's Tale, or, I mean, I could pick any of them and find, you know, the different types of thing. Is there any more pleasure to be had doing something which in itself is lighter and less heavy than The Handmaid's Tale? Or is it always just the same level of difficulty and toughness?
It's definitely all the... that makes it sound like not fun. I mean, it is. It's always the same pressure. And
could you have more fun doing a comedy?
Oh, I don't know. Comedians are very serious people, very dark and depressed often, and really need an awful lot of handholding and
something like
direction.
Little Dart, which is full of colourful characters.
Yeah,
and
also comedy to direct is very, very technical. And French and Saunders, I remember working with their director, like they all comedy to, you know, shoot the close up and so that you can technically put it together in the edit. So all the dialogue has to be covered and the rhythm of it. But Little Dorrit was just a thing of beauty. And I set that up we all know our Dickens, but the British do Dickens so fabulously. And Little Dorrit, when I read that script first, was like, how do you do? I remember my partner at the time saying, please don't make a blue film or a yellow film or, you know, like that period look. But, you know, reading the script of Little Dorrit and going, how can I come up with something? Or how can I kind of connect with this? And really, I kind of went back to Tubbercurry and the idea of, you know, living in this. There were 72 characters in Little Dorrit. It's 1,200 pages, the book, and not one of his better ones or more popular ones. You know, he was writing to pay the bills, and it goes on and on. And but it just reminded me in Dickens' writing of growing up in a small town where you know everybody and everybody has a story. And there are the eccentric characters and the crazies and the colourful and the love stories and the secrets. And just somehow with that, I kind of got my DOP, lovely Swiss man, Lucas Strebel. We found a visual approach, and it was a joy to cast. I mean, I cast 56 of the actors, Tom Courtney.
Claire Foy
was her she was our little dart then.
Andy Serkis was in that.
Yeah. Working with Andy Serkis was amazing. Andy was,
I
remember when
no
he came
direction.
In and he played Rigo, and he wanted a false nose. And he when he came in and talked about the character, he talked about how he saw Rigo as a puma, you know, and he's so physical, and everything he talks about, it's all very expressions of animals. And he was wonderfully colourful in the role, and he was doing it because, you know, these are big actors who, you know, don't earn a lot and doing something like this for the BBC, but kind of wanted their kids to, you know, see them in something that that they're supposed to be reading.
And you got the Emmy. That was 2009. You got the Emmy Award for Outstanding Directing for a Miniseries, Movie or Dramatic Special.
That was the year of David and the Goliath. We were David and we bet the Goliath, which was HBO at the time. They had Generation Kill, and nobody expected us. We were a PBS production. And I went, I arranged a week of meetings before going over because I said, there's no way this is going to happen. And lo and behold.
It's no harm to win an Emmy, is it?
No harm. Everybody loves a winner in America.
Yeah, you get noticed after that. I'm going to have your second last choice now. The Gloaming?
The Gloaming, yeah. I love The Gloaming. I just love what they've done with Irish music. I've always loved Irish music and made documentaries about set dancing and used Irish music at home and abroad. But I think what they're doing is so exciting. And also Irla's voice I find mesmerising. And I had the the good fortune of working with him. I did a very small dance film, and he did the music. Well, actually, it was a reversioning of the lament Queen of Three Wirra. And the Three Marys at the foot of the cross. And it was such an interesting experience to work with him. Again, working with an artist who was induced to singing to pictures. So he sang the song beautifully, but I'd already shot this dance film in a church, and it was all on the subject of abuse. And I went down to his home and worked with him in the studio, and, you know, he thought that'd be just a couple of hours, but... by the end of the day, when we had done a few different versions, but working with him to get him to react and getting him to perform the lament in sync with the pictures was a really wonderful experience.
And what you want to hear now is Cookin' Andy?
Cookin' Andy, just because it's playful and it's fun. And always when I'm away working and you come home at night and you're going, oh, and making the plan for the next day and working on my notes, I always, the gloaming is one of the soundtracks I put on in the background when I'm kind of trying to be creative and think fresh thoughts for the next day in studio. So that's what this, I find this music really kind of from the soul and very creative.
Only word in her, she's horse and trum. Cookin' Andy, Nandy, cookin' Andy, yum. Cookin' Andy, Nandy, cookin' Andy, yum.
That's the gloaming there, and Cookin' Andy. My guest, Dervla Walsh, with me tonight, picking all the music. Your last choice is about to come, so you better make a decision on that, Dervla. But before we let you go, you're currently working on Tales from the Loop. Is that right, or is that done?
I'm just finished. That will go out in the beginning of next year.
And does this mean you're away from home a lot, Amelia?
Yeah, I go. I'm leaving in a couple of weeks. I'm in Chicago for the rest of the year, working on the new series of Fargo with Jesse Buckley and Ben Whishaw and Chris Rock. That's going to be really brilliant.
It's going to be
series.
Really cold. Dervla, listen, thanks a million for coming in. It's great to meet someone who's doing so well. And good luck with it all. And thanks, Dervla, for coming in. Your last choice is what?
My last choice is Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now. And not because of the latest movie it was in, which I know divides people, but because, I love the optimism of this song at the beginning and then the experience of looking back in life. And it was the song that played out my best friend down the aisle as she left this world too early, was my role model and love her dearly, Nisha Notaro. And the fight is to keep optimistic and curious about it all.
Dervla Walsh, thank you very much.
Rose and flows of angel hair, an ice cream castle.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.